in 1 Kings 3, but we're going to start in 2 Samuel 7 just for the purpose of reminding. Because 2 Samuel 7, 12 through 16 really sets the stage for all of the kings and the chronicles, particularly as it has to do with the kings of Judah. The other day, my children, two little ones anyway, obtained a little car from my niece and her husband. The car had been used by their children, just a little small car. And my niece's husband told me, he said, "You can have that car." I said, "We don't want your kids' toy." He said, no, he said, "You can have that car." He said, "We've had it forever." And he said, "It plays a little melody." And he said, "Just between you and me," he said, "I'm tired of hearing it." And it goes, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun- in the recesses of my brain, I hear dun 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 dun. It's an interesting life I live now. Anybody want a car? Is what I'm asking. That's sort of how setting it up. But you can hum or sing that little melody, and the girls smile, which means they like it way too much, and we're never getting rid of that car. So. At the moment, we're still in this time period of Israelites' history known as the Golden Age. The height of Israelite success as a people, Solomon is on the throne. We'll say more about that in just a few minutes. And Israel now, because of Solomon's wise rule, or at least we're moving in that direction, because of it, will influence the nation. And all of the promises of Abraham and given to Moses and even to David we see coming into fulfillment as we study the kings, particularly this era. But in 2 Samuel 7, verse 12, this is what the prophet said to Samuel. Or pardon me, what the prophet Nathan said to David. He said, "When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed, your descendants after you, who will come from your body, your biological children, and I will establish his kingdom. He, this child of David, shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever." Then it ends with, "According to all these words and according to all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David." That brings us back to 1 Kings chapter 3. And we see that particular prophecy being fulfilled in Solomon. We've studied the first couple chapters where we saw how once David became an old man, it was necessary for someone to succeed him. Eventually, Solomon rises to power despite the efforts of some of David's enemies and David's son Adonijah. And so by the time we come to chapter 3, this one who has come from David's body, his seed, his son, is now reigning, just as the prophecy said. Now this son will build David a house. David wanted to build God a physical house. And as we move into these first 11 chapters, that's what we see happening, particularly beginning in chapter 5 and going through chapter 8. Solomon's going to build a temple. But at this juncture, as we move into chapter 3 and chapter 4, this is what we see. Chapter 3, verses 1 to 3, we see the rise of Solomon. We see the rise of Solomon. Verse 4 through 28, the revelation of Solomon, or to him by God. Then chapter 4, the reign of Solomon. He's on the throne now. His enemies are out of the way. He's going to begin to rise in prominence. First three verses. He's going to have a session with God as God appears to him. 4 through 28. And then we'll see the reign of Solomon in all of its glory in chapter 4. It'll be repeated again, really, in chapter 10, but we'll see it for the first time in chapter 4. So let's start now with the rise of Solomon. The rise of Solomon. Let's look at these three verses. It says, "Now Solomon made a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter. Then he brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the people sacrificed at the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days." You might just notice this, this statement here. It says, "And Solomon did what? Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places." The high places were generally pagan worship sites where the Israelites would go and offer sacrifice, not to the pagan gods and goddesses, but to Jehovah. At this time, the tabernacle itself was located at a high place in Gibeon. And there was also another tent in Jerusalem that housed the ark. And so we don't have a stationary worship site. People are worshiping in a number of different places. But the question that we pose as we look at these first three verses, seeing Solomon's rise and what he begins to do, is, are we seeing, for instance, in this statement about Solomon marrying Pharaoh's daughter and this statement about the high places, even though Solomon loves the Lord and happens to be walking in the statutes of David, is there a hint here that something might be amiss? Were the Israelites to marry outside of the faith of Israel? No. How did Egypt fit into Israel's overall history? It's not a good thing. But now, for the purpose most likely of the Confederacy, and evidently he really loved her, Solomon marries her. Should we see something ahead? Is there danger ahead based on this? Or is it just simply describing how Solomon is now influencing the nations? And he is, as his father did, walking with David. Is it negative, this description? Is it positive? Is it both? My buddy Dale Ralph, who wrote the commentary I've been using quite a bit, said scholars argue over verse 1 about whether it paints Solomon in primarily positive colors or in suspiciously sinister tones. That's what we're asking. Is Solomon's marriage to Pharaoh's daughter a sign that Israel now holds the place of honor among the nations? That would be positive, right? Or is it the beginning of infidelity, marrying a foreign wife? Or maybe both? How should we view what's happening in Solomon's life right now? Positively or negatively? I don't know that I have the answer. I'm just trying to help us think. And you're probably thinking to yourself, I'm really tired and sleepy, and lunch is a long time from now. He just keeps going on and on. Nobody has a... Nothing? Okay. Sure. I'm going to suggest that the general picture of Solomon for the first 10 chapters is more positive than negative. That's my suggestion. I can't prove that 100%, but I'm going to affirm that I think that up until chapter 11, although there may be some hints, maybe Solomon's going in directions that he shouldn't, maybe he's getting too close to some of the things that God might not approve of. For the first 10 chapters, I'm going to again suggest that God sees him in a positive light. So we see him rising, perhaps in power, some of these things showing his influence now among the nations. A marriage alliance. It very well may be. Certainly, there's the idea of alliance. Since most of us are familiar with Solomon, I'll go ahead and throw a spoiler in here, okay? Because you've already seen the movie. I mean, most of us have already walked down this path before. Notice the text says that Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of the Lord. He marries a foreign wife, but he loves the Lord, right? If you turn over to chapter 11, when all things go haywire for him, verse 1 says, but King Solomon, here it is again now, loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. And notice the text says, Solomon clung to these in love. Did he marry Pharaoh's daughter because it was a wise political move? I think so. At the same time that he married Pharaoh's daughter, at least after marrying her, did he come to have an emotional attachment to her? A deep one, yes. And to some of these other women as well. Maybe not every wife that he had, because some of them were just concubines. They were just simply, again, playing the role of making peace between nations. But regarding Pharaoh's daughter, it's very likely that he loves her deeply to the point that he compromised his allegiance, his fidelity to God. Okay? So it's both, Bonnie, I think. I think there's no doubt that when we talk about these nations and foreign women, strange women, as the King James Version said, that political alliance is generally in mind, but not always. And evidently Solomon formed a real emotional attachment to some of them. Here's what I think regarding Solomon at this point. If indeed the marrying of Pharaoh's daughter and maybe the reference to the high places, I think the reference to the high places is just setting us up for the building of the temple. Not sure it's necessarily an indictment against Solomon. But here's what we find even when people are faithful. What if someone wrote a record about you and said that something to the effect of so-and-so loved God with all of his heart, and served him all of his days, and was faithful, except that he struggled with anger. Does that mean he's not walking with God, doesn't love God? No, it just simply shows his humanity that despite this struggle that he has, his heart is right and he's striving in the right direction. Now, we might get to the end of that person's life, and the record might say, so-and-so eventually gave in to his outbursts of anger, and it was his undoing. Now suddenly, it's not just a struggle, it's become the dominant reality. It's overtaken him. Sin was crouching at the door, and sin's desire for that person was fulfilled. See the difference? I don't care who we're talking about. I don't care how faithful they are. All of us struggle in some area with the flesh, every one of us, but that doesn't discount us as being faithful people. I think here with Solomon, there's some things in his life that may be out of sorts at this juncture, but generally as a human being and as a man, he loves God. That ought to make us feel better, shouldn't it, to some degree? Not that we overlook sin or make excuse for it, but we're all a work in prospect and process for that matter. All right, so here we see the revelation of or to Solomon. And we read of his prayer for wisdom. I find this to be fascinating. Some great devotional ideas here. Verse 4 says, now the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there. That was where the tabernacle was. That was a great high place. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on the altar. He's a worshipful man. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, ask, what shall I give to you? Now, let's just stop there and let's just Let's just sit there and spread that pallet out and lie down on it and roll around in it for a minute. What if God appeared to you and said that? Ask, what shall I give you? Alan, what are you going to say to him? Nelda, what's your answer going to be? Whatever you ask, I'll give to you. That's no genie in the bottle situation, is it? Yes, sir. Yeah. I find that to be a highly interesting and fascinating concept there. And God says to Solomon, whatever you desire, I'll give it to you. And I might ask you, what would you ask for? And generally, we'll ask for what we love. Think about that for a minute. We might say, I want that person. Lord, give me that person. Lord, give me that thing. We don't know what we need or what we want, right? Solomon gives evidence of what was most important to him by the response that he gives to God. Notice what's said here. Verse 6, and Solomon said, you have shown great mercy to your servant David, my father. He's going to go back to that promise we read about. Because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. That's 2 Samuel 7, 12 to 16 that we read a minute ago. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or to come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart, to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? What does Solomon love at this time? He loves God's people, and in loving God's people, he loves the God of them. Right? He could have asked for anything. He realizes the task before him, and with great insight already, even before he was given largeness of heart and understanding, he says, this is what I need. Then notice verse 10. The petition, please God. In a sense, we might say that Solomon's discussion with God here serves as sort of a prayer, doesn't it? I mean, I know the circumstances are different and there's a vision involved. But what should be the goal of every petition that we set before God Almighty? Verse 10, the speech, the petition, pleased the Lord. That Solomon had asked this thing, then God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked long life for yourself, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have asked the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice, behold, I have done according to your words. We ask anything according to his will, the Bible says he hears us. I have given you a wise and understanding heart so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any like you arise after you. And I've also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings all your days. So if you walk in my ways, keep my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. Then Solomon awoke. So notice 4 through 15, Solomon awakes, and indeed it had been a dream, and he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, offered up burnt offerings, offered peace offerings, and made a feast for all his servants. I think Solomon should be viewed in a very positive light at this point. What he asked pleased God. What he asked is noble and noteworthy. His desires are inclined in the right direction. Again, I think all of us ought to ask ourselves the question, if God said, ask and I will give you whatever, whatever you want from me. I think that the answer is, Lord, I want you. That's what I think. Yes, sir. I think probably most say he was around 40 years old. Just kind of a guess. Somewhere middle-aged now. In fact, when you look at the writings that are attributed to Solomon, like the Song of Solomon, a love story, most say, well, he was probably a young man, maybe in his 20s. Proverbs, such brilliant insight. People say he's probably around this age, around 40, after this wisdom was given to him. And he wrote those pithy statements that cover so much ground, the Proverbs. And then the book of Ecclesiastes was probably written when he was around 60, maybe a little older, when he's coming to the end of his life. And he's loved foreign women. Things haven't worked out for him. And he's rather sorrowful about life. So he may be in the prime of his life, probably here about around the age of 40. We don't know for sure, but it's just what most people think. So the prayer for wisdom, verses 4 through 15. Now, I like this little devotional outline about this prayer of Solomon's. What's the true incentive to pray? Why should we ever pray? Well, there's a lot of reasons, but one that we might find here is the generosity of God. How do we see God's generosity in his dealings with Solomon here? We see it in a couple of ways. Anybody want to take a stab at it? He gives him more than what he asked for. Not only does he give him more, he asks him to ask him. Cast all your cares upon him, for he cares for you. 1 Peter 5:7. The true foundation of prayer. What should in some way always be in the midst of our petitions? The welfare of others. Or pardon me, that's here. The true foundation of prayer is the faithfulness of God. Why should we pray? Because we know that God can respond and will respond faithfully as his will directs. And then what I meant to say, the true anxiety of prayer is the people of God. What should be our greatest concern when we petition God? What should be at the heart of every prayer? God's people. That was Solomon's, what we might refer to as true anxiety. You might be thinking, but didn't Jesus say be anxious for nothing? He did. But in one sense, there's an ungodly anxiety, right? Where we're trusting in self, we're not looking to God. And there's also what we might call a godly anxiety. And that is where we have a deep concern for God's things and God's people. Remember in 2 Corinthians 11, as Paul talked about all the things that he went through, he talked about his daily concern for all the churches. That's a godly anxiety, isn't it? There's such a thing as a sinful jealousy, and there's also such a thing as a godly jealousy. The true goal of prayer, as we said a moment ago, the pleasure of God. Solomon's request pleased the Lord. How do we know that Solomon received what he asked for? 16 through 28, the proof of wisdom. 16 through 28, the proof of wisdom. We can break down this section like this. We have the problem, 16 to 22. The harlots who bring the child for Solomon, the proposal. 23 through 26, divide the child. The protest, no, give the child to the other woman. The true mother said, and then 27 through 28, the pronouncement, Solomon decides the case, and we'll see this as we read it and as it plays out. How do we know Solomon received what he asked for? Verse 16. Now two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him, and the woman said, "Oh my lord, this woman and I dwell in the same house, and I gave birth while she was in the house. Then it happened the third day after I had given birth that this woman also gave birth, and we were together. No one was with us in the house except the two of us in the house. And the woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. So she arose in the middle of the night, took my son from my side while your maidservant slept, and laid him in her bosom, and laid her dead child in my bosom. And when I rose in the morning to nurse my son, there he was dead. But when I had examined him in the morning, indeed he was not my son whom I had born." Then the other woman said, "No, but the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son." And the first woman said, "No, but the dead one is your son, and the living one is my son." Thus they spoke before the king. Now just kind of picture this. You know, one of the functions of the king was to determine civil cases. He was a king, but he was also a judge. Just as it was the case in the days of the judges, those men and women that God raised up, they would oftentimes sit at the city gates and decide cases when people had disputes. Just imagine, these are two prostitutes who have come before Solomon with a dead child. You can see them wrangling before him. And perhaps he sits in silence, just sort of monitoring the situation, listening and watching closely. Verse 23 says, and the king said, the one said, this is my son who lives, and your son is a dead one. And the other says, no, but your son is a dead one, and my son is a living one. Then the king said, bring me a sword. So they brought a sword before the king, and the king said, divide the living child in two, and give half to one and half to the other. Then the woman whose son was living spoke to the king, for she yearned with compassion for her son. And she said, oh my lord, give her the living child, and by no means kill him. But the other said, let him be neither mine nor yours, but divide him. And it's interesting here, there's, I think, wired into women is what we might refer to, or the Bible refers to, as natural affection. That is, a love for a son, a daughter, the baby that they bore. It's apparent here that the woman whose son actually died did not possess that sort of affection for this child. And it may be she possessed what Titus chapter, what would that be? 2 Timothy chapter 3 speaks of. She possessed an unnatural affection. Most women, if it's a child that belongs to them or not, will have compassion on a baby. Most men will too, but it's certainly apparent in a woman who's had a child, she then feels motherly to every other child. And so Solomon sets up this situation to show or to prove who was actually the baby's mother, and the one who killed her son by suffocating it accidentally, it's apparent the child doesn't belong to her. So the king said, verse 27, give the first one the living child and by no means kill him. She is his mother. And notice this case evidently became well known. And all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had rendered, and they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. God said, I'll give you a large and understanding heart to discern good and evil and to judge this people. Do you think this was the only event? Probably not. There were probably a series of events regarding Solomon's wise judgment that became public, and this is just one that stood out to the author, and he reminds us, shows us that what God said he would do, he does. Now, chapter 4, this won't take very long, believe it or not. Verse 1 through verse 34 describes the reign of Solomon. Okay? He's now asked for wisdom. He's demonstrating wisdom, that he has the wisdom of God. And if you look at the first 9 verses, we're not even going to read it. I have it as his people. In other words, it's Solomon's administration, where he talks about, or the author records for us, the people that he put in certain positions to aid him in the running of his kingdom. Now the question is, why would it be necessary for the author, who wrote this long after Solomon's day, to remind us of all of these people? I mean, it's been rather interesting. Chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, with all the events, with the political intrigue and the passing of the torch from David to Solomon in the first 2 chapters, and people being executed in chapter 3, God's appearing to Solomon, and then this court case where Solomon makes this decision that shows great wisdom, and then suddenly he throws this list of names in here. This is one of those ones where we're doing our daily Bible reading and we go, right? Just move on past that. We don't need to pay attention to that. And let me say this, it doesn't make for good reading. And let me suggest that it's not even there for the purpose of good reading. But it's there to demonstrate that Solomon shows wisdom in everything, including his ability to order and to organize and to put the right people in the right place. Like this statement. Yet what does all this have to do with anything, this list of names? What does it matter to me that Zabad is the king's personal advisor, that Ahinadab is over around Mahanaim rounding up royal provisions? He says, why do I care about any of that? Why these lists? And he says, because they are further evidence of the wisdom God gave Solomon. There is a wideness in biblical wisdom. It's not only It is not only concerned with moral and accurate judgments, but also with efficient and orderly structure that keeps chaos and waste from running life. It's a reminder that Solomon, regarding his rule, he had the wisdom and the keen insight to put so-and-so here and so-and-so there and to delegate authority over here. And some of these are, when you read through the list, some of it's just simply describing those who would go and collect tax from the people. So it's almost a list in some ways of IRS agents. And Burton Kaufman said that it's about as interesting as reading a list of IRS agents in today's society, you know. But it has its place, doesn't it? It's a reminder. Now here's what really matters, his prosperity. And we can get through this and cover two chapters today. You drop down to verse 20. It says, Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. Now remember the promise that God gave to Abraham? When Abraham left the Ur of the Chaldees, he said, I'll make you a great nation. Then when you get to chapter 13, chapter 15, a number of those chapters in Genesis, God says things like, I'm going to make you a great nation, and your descendants will number the particles of sand on the seashore. Your descendants will number the stars in the sky. They'll be innumerable. What do we see at this juncture in Israelite history as Solomon sits on the throne? What has Israel become? A great, innumerable nation of people, just as God said he would do when he said it to Abraham hundreds of years before. Verse 21, so Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Now, as you read down through here, what you see is the land that was promised to Abraham, its dimensions, like in Genesis 13. How much of that strip of land on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea would Abraham and his people own? Well, God describes it. Genesis 13. Here in 1 Kings 4, we learn that when Solomon reigned, all of the land that God said Israel would rule over, they do. Now, I bring that up because there are some who say the Jews never received all of the land that they were supposed to receive, and therefore that's still yet future. But 1 Kings 4 shows us that what God promised Abraham became a reality during Solomon's reign. Verse 22 says, now Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures, and 100 sheep besides deer, gazelles, roebuck, and fatted fowl. For he had dominion over all the region on this side of the river, from Tifsa even to Gaza, namely over all the kings on this side of all the river. And he had peace on every side all around him. And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan as far as Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. One of the promises that was made to David was, you'll have a son who will build me a house. And he'll be able to because there will be rest in the land. He won't have to go out and fight battles and wars. David couldn't build the house because he was a man of war. He shed much blood. He was always fighting. There was always turmoil. He couldn't engage in a building project like that. But now the land is at rest. Verse 26 says, Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots, 12,000 horsemen. That may be a hint of things to come, not so good because kings weren't supposed to multiply those kind of things. But still, there's a positive light. And these governors, each man in his month, provided food for King Solomon and for all who came to King Solomon's table. There was no lack in their supply. They also brought barley and straw to the proper place for the horses, steeds, each man according to his charge. And notice, here's the answer to what Solomon prayed. And God gave Solomon wisdom. How do we know that? Just look at his kingdom. An exceedingly great understanding and largest of heart like the sand in the seashore, or on the seashore. Thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men, than Ethan, the Ezrahite, and Heman, Calkal, and Darda, the sons of Mahal, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. Also he spoke of trees, from cedar trees of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. And men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth, who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. The joy of wisdom. We see fulfilled prophecy regarding this line. We just said regarding his people. They became a great multitude. Regarding place, all the land was given. Regarding peace, there was rest on every side. God answered all of the, or God fulfilled all the promises that he'd made going back to Abraham here in 1 Kings chapter 4. And I think the last thing we might notice here, the excellence of his wisdom is given to Solomon. Where did it come from? Verse 29, from God, its source. What was its superiority? Greater wisdom than in all the other nations, 30 and 31 in its scope. His wisdom covered both the moral and the material, both living and even lyrics. He was a great songwriter. He was wise in every sense of the word. We covered two chapters. But now Solomon is on the throne, and when the Jews were looking for a Messiah in the first century, when they talked about the Messiah and they thought about what would happen and what life would be like once he came, they looked back to this. They looked back to Solomon's reign and all of his success. And so when Jesus came and was crucified on a Roman cross, you can imagine how that was a stumbling block. We're looking for a king like Solomon. A king who will prosper like Solomon, and one like David who will run out all of our enemies and defeat them all around us. But that wasn't what Jesus came to accomplish. Yes? Could we get Solomon? Well, if we could find a young Solomon, we don't want the old Solomon, okay? He'll get us in a lot of trouble. Huh? Yeah, you know, you can imagine the media would have a field day with that one. I'm sure out of 700, they could find several who weren't very happy and had some dirt on Solomon. I heard a guy say one time, you know, with 700 wives, he said, surely when you'd come home, you'd find one of them in a good mood. So, hey, don't stone the messenger. I'm just telling you the joke. I didn't even say it was right.